My theme text, which I'm going to do first instead of at the end this time, is in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Would you look there with me very quickly? Got a lot of story to share with you today. I believe you'll be blessed by the life of John Bunyan. But Bunyan gives testimony of how the Lord sustained him during his many years in prison. And the verse that he specifically cites is 2 Corinthians 1, verse 9 and 10. Paul says, "For this is why I wrote, I started reading chapter 2, and I wondered why it wasn't the right verse. So let's read the verse that I actually announced, 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 9. Indeed, Paul wrote, we felt that we had received the sentence of death, but that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. He delivered us from such a deadly peril, and He will deliver us. On Him we have set our hope that He will deliver us again." So Paul says, we have the sentence of death in ourselves. But that's a good thing, because that means we're not trusting in ourselves. We're trusting on God, because God raises the dead. He controls all of it. And Bunyan is going to give testimony that when everything appeared to be lost, he said, you know, that's a good thing. Because when it all dies, then I've still got God. And I've maybe got Him in a more real way than I ever have before. So the impact of the Pilgrim's Progress from this world to that which is to come has been worldwide. Part 1 was published in 1677. Part 2 was published in 1684. It's been translated into over 200 languages. And as Pastor Michael said, it's until recent times when electronic publishing just kind of messed up all these stats. The second most read book behind only the Bible. And if you and your family have not read it recently, then I hope this will inspire you to pull it down and open it again, because it is chock full of good theology. There's Mr. Bunyan, and here's his story. Born in 1628, so I'm going to divide his life up chronologically. And for the first 19 years, we could call him a reckless youth. He lived in a small town outside Bedford, the little town of Elstow. You can see the inset map there where this county is. It's about 60 miles north of London. Bedford is the largest city in Bedfordshire, but Elstow is just a tiny little suburb outside Bedford. November 28, 1628. His dad was a tinker. You know, we're staying with someone who's really good with his hands, and I haven't said to him directly, but I find that very intimidating because I couldn't fix my kids' toys. You know, if one of the kids said, my toy broke, I'd said, I'll buy you a new one. All right. No gifts that way at all. But Bunyan grew up in a home where his dad was the neighborhood family man, neighborhood handyman. So a tinker, or more precisely a brazier, was someone who had a bellows at his home, and people would bring him things to fix, but he would also take his bag of tools and an anvil. He carried an anvil around the county with him, so these were not, you know. He'd go to people's farms and say, what's broken? And he'd mend it, and he could fix anything. You don't have to have a lot of education to do that, and Bunyan didn't get much education, because if you're a tinker's kid, you're going to be a tinker. They were Anglicans. That is, they attended the local Anglican church, which meant that Bunyan was sprinkled as a baby and said, I baptize you. Now, there were Church of England churches. The Anglican church is the official Church of England. There were Church of England churches that preached the gospel in England that were associated with sort of the remnants of Puritanism, but not many, and not the one the Bunyans attended. That is, it was just kind of a social church. Everybody goes because that's what you do. And this family was extremely poor, because you don't get rich being a tinker. So Bunyan was put in grammar school until he was about 10 years old. And by the time you're 10 years old, you need an education that will actually fit you for life. And that means learning how to fix things. And he's pulled out of school. And as a child, he says in his autobiography, I was afraid of hell, because every once in a while at church, I'd hear that there's a place called hell. And I knew that I was not a very good person. But he wasn't told the gospel, so we didn't know what the solution to this problem was. And when you don't have a solution, then the problem will generally harden into can't solve the problem, so why worry about it? And as a young person, he became notorious as a sinner. He was the leader of the village gang. Now, when you read Bunyan's autobiography, it's kind of like reading Augustine's autobiography, where Augustine talks about what a terrible sinner he was, and then he gives an example. I stole a piece of fruit, and you say, you know, there are worse things. But Augustine uses that example to say, I wasn't even hungry. I just wanted to get away with stealing a piece of fruit. And Augustine's point is that don't measure a sin by its social consequences. Measure it by your attitude towards the God who gave you the law. And my attitude was, if I can get away with it, I will. So if you'd steal a fruit, just because a piece of fruit just because you can, you'd murder 10,000 people if you could, because it's the heart that matters. And Bunyan says, I had a foul mouth. During odd times, like at 11 at night or something, my buddies and I would sneak over to the church and ring the church bells. Well, that was very annoying, because the church bells were supposed to call people to services and to convocation. Everybody was kind of annoyed by that. And they played Tip Cat. Tip Cat was this game where they had a small sort of leather ball, and they had a stick, and they would dig a hole in the ground and stand in the hole sort of knee-deep, and then they would hit the cat with the stick, and then they would hit it again and see how far they could hit it. It seems kind of rudimentary, but it's obviously a precursor to more modern games. And there's nothing particularly wrong with Tip Cat, except that they always played on Sunday. Why on Sunday? Well, because everyone in England at the time, even the very nominally religious people, were Sabbatarians and believed that you shouldn't do sports on Sunday. And that's their main reason for playing. So he and his buddies would all go sit in church, and then when they got out of church, they'd go out on the village green and play Tip Cat because it made all the adults angry. And he says, I was one of those great sin breeders. I infected all the youth of the town where I was born with all manner of youthful vanities. So it's not like he's committing adultery and killing people, but he's sinning as much as he can in a small town. Well, at age 16, the providence of God gets his attention in a way that was hard. His mom died, and shortly thereafter his sister died as plague came through their community. Plague came through the communities periodically. Sometimes it was on a huge scale, sometimes on a small scale. But when it came, a certain number of people died. If you didn't, you were thankful, but then you were grieving. His dad, within weeks, remarried. In fact, the length of time was considered scandalous. And Bunyan didn't particularly appreciate it, and he enlisted in the Parliamentary Army, perhaps to get away from the situation. There's a lot about this we don't know for sure. But he goes off to fight. Because it's now 1644, and I cannot give you a lot of political background. This is a very tumultuous time in English history. The king is Charles I. Charles I has gotten into a feud with Parliament. Parliament, rather than kowtowing to him, has said, we will not support your policies. Charles raises an army, essentially starting a civil war against his own Parliament. Parliament raises his own army, and now you've got a real civil war going on. And that county, Bedfordshire, was largely a parliamentary county, although it was divided. I mean, England was not divided, draw a line, one half royalist, the other half parliamentary. Virtually every community was divided. Think about all the Biden and Trump signs around, you know, sometimes side by side in yards, you know, 2 yards side by side. Well, that's what was going on in England, where you've got people who are adamantly pro-Charles and you've got people who are adamantly pro-Parliament, and war has broken out. While he's in military service, he just has garrison duty. He's stationed at the city of Newport Pagnell there in Bedfordshire. And while he's there, the army commanders invite Puritan preachers to come preach at the garrison, and he's exposed to some of this preaching. He also reports that his life was spared. He was assigned a sentinel duty, I'm sorry, it was a siege. We think it was probably the siege of Oxford, which was never successful. They never captured it. But his part of his post went to besiege Oxford, and he was assigned to it. And he said, somebody else in the unit said, can I take your place, and you can take my place next time, but I want to go on this one. And Bunyan said, well, okay. And so Bunyan stayed behind, and that other guy went. And while that guy was marching as a sentinel, he was hit by a musket shot in the head and died instantly. And Bunyan said, that was such a random event, that would be me, I'd be dead. And so after being a very reckless youth, he's beginning to think that, you know, life may not be 70 years long like I thought. After 3 years, he was discharged from the army. He never saw active duty. An interesting thing is, though, if you study the stats from the era, life expectancy in the garrisons was roughly the same as life expectancy on the front lines. That is, there's so much disease that it was dangerous. But he went home. He's now 19 years old. And so far, his life's not amounted to much. For the next 8 years, I would call this poor painted hypocrite. First thing is he gets married. He marries right after he gets back. We know nothing about courtship. We know nothing about how he met this woman. Presumably, she was a young lady there in the community. Bunyan, in his extensive writings, never tells us her name. They seem to have had a wonderful marriage. He just never got around to mentioning her name. We think her name was Mary. There was a very strong convention at the time that when you had a daughter as your firstborn, you would name her after the mother. And their first daughter's name was Mary. Mary was an orphan, but she came from a godly heritage, and she brought a couple of Puritan books into their marriage that she encouraged her husband to read. She may have been a believer. One of those books has been preserved, and you can see it in the Bunyan Library over in Bedford. And it's inscribed with the letters MB, which people think may be Mary Bunyan. But obviously we're patching things together here a little bit. But Bunyan decides he's a married man now, and so I better clean up my act. I need to stop being such a ruffian. And shortly after their marriage, they have a baby, Mary, and she's blind. Well, that's a huge hardship in the 17th century. We've got to care for a blind daughter. He's working as a tinker. All right, his dad's still living, but they're sort of dividing the work between them, and he's going around working as a tinker. They're attending the Anglican church, and he thinks this whole religious thing is impressive. He's never really paid attention before, but now he's a family man, and he needs to be spiritual. And so he goes to church, and he sees priests and robes and formalism, and he thinks, all right, I can do this. So I'm going to be a good guy. And he's surrounded by his old buddies that used to be their ringleader. And on Sunday, they say after church, hey, you want to go play tip-cat? He goes, yeah. And then he's working as a tinker, and he hits his thumb, and the same words come out that used to come out. And pretty soon, he's extremely frustrated that no matter how hard he tries, the conviction just goes away instantly. He can't hold on to this desire. They're alien desires to him. They're not coming from his heart. He just kind of has the thought that a dad ought to be a good guy. And so he's struggling and is experiencing significant conviction. And on one particular Sabbath, I speak as a fool, it was a Sunday, but using their language, on one particular Sabbath, the Anglican priest, who is not a particularly godly guy, preached a sermon on Sabbath breaking. You guys need to stop playing tip-cat on Sabbath. And afterwards, they went out to play tip-cat. Because he was conscious of the fact that he really didn't have any power to change. So he tells a story that he was out on the green playing tip-cat. And he says, as I was in the midst of a game at cat, and by the way, I love the fact that the little thing they're smacking with a stick is a cat. I find that appealing. All right. But as in the midst of a game at cat, and having struck it one blow from the hole, just as I was about to strike it the second time, a voice did suddenly dart from heaven into my soul. Now, it's important that we recognize this in his soul. We'll say more about that later. But that voice says, wilt thou leave thy sins and go to heaven, or have thy sins and go to hell? In other words, he's feeling this conviction very strongly, and he doesn't know what to do about this. My state, he responded, is surely miserable. Miserable if I leave my sins, and but miserable if I follow them. I can but be damned, and if I must be so, I had as good be damned for many sins as to be damned for few. And he decides that, you know what? I might as well just go on in sin. I was persuaded I could never attain to other comfort than what I should get in sin. For heaven was gone already, so that I thought I must not think. That as I've sinned my way of any chance, if the priest is right, and you got to be good enough to go to heaven, I'm clearly never going to be good enough. Just look at my track record. And so if I'm going to go to hell anyway, go for it. And so even though he was a married man now and had a blind daughter and was trying to work a job, he became as reckless as ever. He didn't even care about his speech. He didn't care what anybody thought. Now, again, there's no evidence that he cheated on his wife. There's no evidence that he's hanging out at taverns. But he's being as wicked as he wants to be. Abandonment to recklessness. And the providence of God intervenes again, where he's walking down the street, upset with a client who has cheated him out of some money, and he's cussing and fuming, and there's this woman sitting on the deck of her home or a business, but he's passing by, and she confronts him. And she says, "Bunyan, you're the ungodliest fellow for swearing that I've ever heard. You're going to spoil all the youth in the town." You say, "Well, that's just one more rebuke." No, this woman was known as the wickedest woman in town. I mean, she was the sleep with all the men in town woman. And he got to thinking, listen, if that woman's rebuking me, I'm in bad shape. And so he decides, I'm going to take another run at this. I'm going to change this time. Nothing's going to stop me this time. And, you know, he gets a jar. I'm paraphrasing a little, but he gets a jar and starts throwing coins in every time he cusses. He's going to beat this thing. You know, he stops playing tip cat. He is at church every week with his wife and son. He is going to beat it this time. He wrote later, "I was a poor, painted hypocrite, proud of his godliness, doing all he did either be seen of or well spoken of by man." This goes on for 5 years. That is, he is up, down, up, down, up, down, trying to change. And then one day, he's in a neighboring village, and he runs into a group of ladies who are talking to one another. They're members of a little church in Bedford. The Anglican church at Bedford, because of political circumstances, the Puritans had gotten control of things by now, and the Puritans were applying pressure to pro-Church of England, high church people, and the rector of the church in Bedford had fled, and the Baptists had moved in, right? And they had taken over the church. Now, they weren't fully Baptists. They were sort of open communion, open membership, but they were preaching the gospel, and they called themselves the Bedford Meeting, and they were meeting in St. John's Church. I mean, these beautiful facilities that they just sort of co-opted because the Anglicans had fled the town. And these women who were members of this church and had a dynamic young pastor named McGifford. Gifford had been saved out of a reckless life of seafaring and swearing and all that. He had gotten saved. He'd only been saved like 6 years, and he's pastoring now this little church. And these women are saying, "Isn't it wonderful how when you receive the new birth, everything changes and you get power to live a holy life?" And Bunyan says, "What are you guys talking about?" And they explained it to him. They explained to him, "You must be born again." Bunyan said, "I had never heard that part of it. I had just heard that I needed to be a new person. Not that God does it. Not that godliness is a gift." It is very possible that at this point, Bunyan got saved. There's a lot of controversy about exactly when Bunyan got saved. Within 2 years, we know he's going to be saved. But these next 2 years are going to be rough. So I ask the question, is he really a believer? He begins reading Puritans in earnest. And he discovers a wealth of theology there. He also discovers that these Puritans say that here are the kind of people who get saved. People who are elect from the foundation of the world get saved. They're the ones who are given the gift of faith. And so Bunyan starts asking, if faith is a gift, how do you know whether you've received it? And if election determines whether you're saved, how do you know whether you're elect? And for probably a year, he wrestles with assurance. Maybe he wrestles with salvation. It's Bunyan scholars are divided sort of 50-50 on this. I'm inclined to think that he's already a believer. But he's been exposed to this theology and he's just not sure how to handle it. He's asking what I believe are all the wrong questions. Am I elect? Have I been granted faith? These are bad questions. These are not questions anybody in the New Testament asks. The only way you can know whether you're elect is to look back and say, "I trusted." Right? That wouldn't happen if I were not. The only way to know if you've been granted faith is to believe. And he met this pastor, Gifford, and Gifford said, "Bunyan, let's meet and talk about this." And they started having regular meetings. He started attending the Bedford meeting. They were meeting in St. John's Church, as I mentioned. That church is still standing. And they were kind of Baptist. All right. It's, once again, when you have a church that says, when you get saved, you ought to be immersed. However, if you were sprinkled as a baby, that's fine. We'll take you. And so they had open membership to anybody who said they were a believer. And therefore, everyone was welcome to celebrate communion. It's sort of Baptist in italics. But that's what Gifford believed, and that's what this little assembly taught, and they met in that building, which is still there. Yes. Yes. The profile fits quite well. It actually does. And so, Bunyan, by 1653, is baptized by Pastor Gifford. Again, maybe he was saved as early as age 23 when those women first witnessed to him. Maybe he gets saved closer to 25, but by age 25, Gifford is convinced this man really knows the Lord, and he immerses him in the river, however English people pronounce that. 25 years of age, this long, difficult path is passed. I may say this a little later. I don't remember, but let me make the point now while I think it'll make sense to you. When you read Pilgrim's Progress, there's this puzzling thing about it. Christian passes through the wicket gate, which clearly symbolizes regeneration, conversion. And then he's still got this burden on his back, and he carries it and carries it and carries it, and he finally comes to the cross, and it rolls off. And the question readers have had ever since is, well, when did this guy get saved? When it passed through the wicket gate or when he got to the cross? He can't be saved without the cross, and yet it's a little confusing. In fact, Spurgeon did not like that. He read Pilgrim's Progress over 100 times in his lifetime, but he often criticized it for confusion about when the burden rolls off. I believe Bunyan is simply reflecting his own testimony, that for him, the burden rolling off is receiving assurance that you are truly saved. And the only way you get that assurance is by having the cross drive out all thoughts of your own adequacy. But he believed, I think, that he had passed through the wicket gate 2 years earlier. He just didn't have the confidence that he needed. So that's my belief, and the primary biography I read for Bunyan is Faith Cook's Fearless Pilgrim. I warmly recommend it to you all. Wonderful biography. And that's how she argues about his life as well. So he struggled with assurance of salvation, still felt the tug of old habits, felt he was carrying a burden on his back. And he has this experience. As I was passing in the field, and that too was some dashes on my conscience, that is, he was still aware of struggles to measure up to God's standards, suddenly this sentence fell upon my soul. Thy righteousness is in heaven. And methought withal, I saw with the eyes of my soul Jesus Christ at God's right hand. There I saw is my righteousness, so that wherever I was or whatever I was a-doing, God could not say of me, he wants or lacks my righteousness. For that was just before him. I also saw, moreover, that it was not my good frame of heart that made my righteousness better, nor yet my bad frame that made my righteousness worse. For my righteousness was Jesus Christ himself, the same yesterday and today and forever. All right, that's the theology that frees you from the treadmill of trying to earn God's favor, whether you're lost or saved. That's the righteousness that makes me accepted in the beloved. And twice now, we've had Bunyan talking about these thoughts being dashed into his heart, and he sounds a little charismatic. So let me stay with us. We'll come back to that. But he was 65. He was 1655. He's now 27 years old when he has this experience. There's been an 8-year pilgrimage, and the burden is finally gone. And it's just in time, because God puts him into severe trial. Pastor Gifford dies. Young man, personal mentor, someone who has poured himself into Bunyan's life. And while I can disagree with his ecclesiology, there's no question in Gifford's love for Jesus Christ. About that time, this new group, the Quakers, come sweeping into Bedfordshire. George Fox had taught that, yeah, the Bible's helpful, but if you really want to experience God, it's this inner light that you have in your soul. And the inner light is given to every man, according to John chapter 1. The light that lighteth every man is this inner light that illumines you. And the Bible is a helpful support to that inner light, but the inner light is what will show you truth and lead you in the way of goodness. And the Quakers were just exploding across England. And while most Quakers nowadays, the Society of Friends, have kind of settled down, and if you go to one of their churches, it feels like an evangelical church. Back then, the Quakers were just crazy people. I mean, they were doing just insane things, interrupting services and doing all kinds of things to get people's attention. And Bunyan said, there's something wrong with what these Quakers are saying, because it's not some feeling you have that determines truth. It's God's word that determines truth. And so, he took a huge step for a tinker with basically a second or third grade education whose pastor had just died. He decided to write a book. He's exhorting at St. John's. The church has grown to about 90 people. He's admonishing the surrounding villages. And people can't believe how well this tinker can explain things. That is, he is a student of the word, and God gifted him with massive intellect. Everybody has different gifts, and you can study lots of people in church history who have different levels of gifting, and they can all be used. This guy could read something and understand it even without somebody to teach him. His preaching was so effective that later people are going to compare it to cannonballs smashing through buckets of eggshells. All right, that's my favorite metaphor for preaching in all of church history. Now, that's probably a little later in Bunyan's life, but he's developing. Meanwhile, his family's growing. I jumped the gun a little on the book. It's coming. Elizabeth is born in 1654. John is born in 1656. The family now consists of his wife, Mary, his blind little daughter who's 6 years old, Elizabeth, the two-year-old, and a brand new infant. Some of you know what this phase of life is like. Yeah. And he's a busy man working as a tinker, trying to support this family. He doesn't have ordination. He can't legally get ordination. And he decides to write a book, Some Gospel Truths Opened. It is a refutation of Quakerism. And it is a refutation of the idea that some kind of mystical divine light is what gets you to the truth. Interesting how he goes about it. He says, if you cut yourself off from the scriptures, you cut yourself off from the historical Christ. You might have some vision from the divine Savior, the divine Christ in heaven somewhere, supposedly. But the historical Christ is known only here. And it is the historical Christ who saves us from our sins. Now that's a remarkable insight for this unlearned tinker. He then speaks of the centrality of the written word as the only route to the historical facts that form the gospel. Will people read a book by a tinker? I mean, why would anybody buy Bunyan's book? And so, a pastor in the area by the name of John Burton, who's otherwise very little known, writes the preface to the book and said, Bunyan has the 3 degrees that qualify him to teach. Doesn't have any college degrees, but he hath, through grace, taken 3 heavenly degrees. He's got union with Christ, he's got the anointing of the Spirit, and he's got experience of the temptations of Satan, which do more fit a man for preaching the gospel than all the university learning and degrees that can be had. Now, I teach at a university. I think university degrees can be very helpful. But are they essential? Yeah, Moody didn't have any. Spurgeon didn't have any. Bob Jones Sr. didn't have any. Somehow you can manage without them. But now if you have the opportunity and you scorn it, that's not a good path to success. But Bunyan here has these 3 degrees. That 5-year battle, that 8-year battle, if we expand the whole thing, to find Christ, to find assurance, it has taught him a lot about himself and about the gospel. So his preaching ministry expands because now people are reading his book and saying, man, this guy has good insight. And there are threats that emerge from a preaching ministry like this. There's opposition. This is a highly stratified society. That is, there are upper classes, there's an emerging middle class, and then there's all these people who should keep their mouths shut. What right do they have to have an opinion? And Bunyan belongs to that bottom class. In fact, he's at the bottom of that bottom class. And he's going around preaching without permission from any of his betters. There was considerable social conflict here. He was considered someone who was undermining the state of society. Furthermore, he's got the threat of his own pride because he's a young believer. And suddenly people are gathering in barns and in assemblies and in fields and at St. John's Church, and they want to hear this thinker preach. And then he is slandered. People make up all kinds of stories about this traveling preacher, none of which, as far as we can tell, are true. So he is becoming a sufferer. And as he is experiencing the suffering, dealing with internal and external conflict, another horrible trial enters his life. And in 1658, his wife Mary dies. She was about 28 years old. She was giving birth to Thomas. Thomas survived. She did not. So now Bunyan has 4 small children, and he's a widower. Right about that time, Oliver Cromwell dies, age 59. Oliver Cromwell was the Lord Protector of England. Cromwell has his faults. I get that. Some of them are enormous faults. I do genuinely think I'm going to meet him someday. Can't judge his heart, but he loved Christ. And he had held the government together for about the last 9 years. And he was a young man. And suddenly he's dead. His son Richard was a good man, but nowhere qualified to be the Lord Protector. And England plunges into anarchy. The next 2 years are one of the roughest periods in all of English history. And so things are just falling apart everywhere. And Bunyan has lost his wife. And then God leads him to a very young lady, Elizabeth. She's just 20 years old. All right, Bunyan is now 31. He needs help with these four kids, and he got a good one. All right, Elizabeth was a loving helper. Well, I'll say more about her. What a godly woman. She cared for his four children. She cared for him, freed him up to expanded preaching, and things are looking pretty good. That is, he's never been installed as the official pastor. In fact, that man, John Burton, that I mentioned, who wrote the foreword, he became the pastor there at the Bedford meeting. And Bunyan is simply a layman, exhorting, traveling around, but people want to hear this man preach. He's also written a second book against the Quakers. He also compiles his sermons into a book. He's putting out books. And then in 1660, everything changes. In 1660, the government decides that we need the king back. They had executed Charles I, beheaded him, sent shockwaves through England, because all the royal houses are intermarried. They're all related to each other. And when the king of France, and the king of Spain, and the king of various German states, they all find out that cousin Charles has been executed, it's horrific. Oliver Cromwell takes over the government, but he never calls himself king. It's the protectorate. And now the people say, we want Charles's son, Charles II, back. They bring Charles II back. 1660, Charles II, one of the worst kings England ever had. Deeply, deeply immoral man. Didn't care about religion that much. In fact, when he came to the throne, he promised that he said, the people who actually executed my dad, I'm going to punish them. But everybody else, I'll just leave alone. I just want peace to reign. I'm going to be easygoing. And then he allowed a parliament to form that was entirely consisting of people who wanted revenge. And they set out to avenge themselves. And a whole series of laws were passed against any dissenters in England, anyone who would not fully submit to the Church of England. And there was sweeping persecution. And within less than 3 months of Charles coming to the throne, John Bunyan was arrested. He was speaking in a barn in Lower Samsell near Harlington, which is a small community in Bedfordshire. Folk had gathered to hear him, and the farmer who had invited him to do it came to Bunyan and said, I just heard that the local magistrates, who you know hate you, they've always hated you, they've issued a writ for your arrest. And Bunyan said, you know, I don't think I'm going to flee. I think I'm going to preach. And as he was being led away, he said, we might have been apprehended as thieves and murderers. But blessed be God, it was not so, but we suffer as Christians for well-doing, and we had better be the persecuted than the persecutors. That is, we have a lot to be thankful for. And Bunyan was put in jail. Bedford County Jail. You think of jails nowadays, you think of places where you are fed, where you are given rudimentary clothing, you're isolated, but you're treated reasonably well. We have laws against mistreating prisoners. Not so in Bedford County Jail or any jail in the 17th century. You ate what your relatives brought you. They provided no food. It was a three-story jail. The top floor was kept relatively clean, but it was still rat-infested and filthy. Second floor was much worse. The ground floor was for violent criminals, and it was horrific conditions. Bunyan was probably put on the top floor because he was a preacher, he was harmless, but they had to provide their own bedding, their own food. It was unsanitary. And every winter, a substantial percentage of the prisoners would die because there was no artificial heating, and it was just dangerous. And if you caught a disease of the lung or whatever, you were going to die. So you don't survive in these prisons for that long. Elizabeth was pregnant with his fifth child. That is, they had the four little ones, and now Elizabeth is pregnant. And the arrest sends her into convulsions. I mean, she is traveling. She is running around to the different political leaders, begging them to release her husband. And she goes into premature labor and gives birth to a dead baby. Bunyan has now lost a child. His brand new wife, they've been married, less than a year. He's got four children, one of whom is blind, and he's scared to death for. He doesn't know how they're going to be cared for. The parting with my wife and poor children has oft been to me in this place as the pulling of the flesh from my bones. Here's a famous painting of his blind daughter Mary visiting him in prison, and this is highly sanitized. It didn't look like that. It was horrible conditions. So they bring him before a panel of judges after about 5 months, and the lead judge was someone who had just been released from 18 years in prison for supporting Charles I. Much nicer prison conditions in London. And so there's not a lot of hope for Bunyan here. And they pass sentence on him. They say, you are going to spend 3 months in this prison. If you have not repented by then and agreed not to preach, then you will be banished from the country. If you are found anywhere in the realm after that decree of banishment, you will be executed. So, give up preaching or else. And then they said, but you're a tinker. You're not a preacher. You're not even the pastor of your local church. Just tell us you won't preach and you're free. And they're leading Bunyan out of the courtroom. And he says, I looked back and I called out, if I am let out of prison today, I will be preaching the gospel again tomorrow by the grace of God, by the help of God. You say, is he just being stubborn? Well, maybe a little. He also believes he's got a calling from God to preach. And he won't let go of that. Well, in 1661, there is a general amnesty declared for prisoners when Charles II is placed as on the throne. And long lists of prisoners are sent out to all the jails to be released. And Bunyan's name is not on the list. The local magistrate who hated Bunyan had made sure his name didn't get... Bunyan is watching thieves and all kinds of vicious prisoners being let out of the jail, and he, the preacher, is being left in jail. And his wife, Elizabeth, was devastated. And so she travels to London. She is a woman of 21, 22 years old, and she makes a trip the 60 miles to London by herself, makes her way to the House of Lords, and meets with one of the lords in charge of that part of England and presents a petition begging him to allow her husband out of jail. He was actually sympathetic to Puritan causes, and it was really thought it would work. And for political reasons, he said, I can't do that. I can't override all the local magistrates. And Bunyan's chance of getting out is gone. From summer 61 to summer 62, though, the jailer was kind of a nice guy. Because he looked around and said, it wasn't fair for Bunyan to be left here. And he's not doing anybody any harm. So he said, whenever you want to go preach, I'll let you. And Bunyan got out and preached in neighboring areas, surrounding areas. And then Bunyan at one point said, do you mind if I go to London? I got an invitation to preach in London. And the jailer says, well, kind of lie low, but that'd be fine. And he went to London. And visitors from the government came through Bedford with a list of prisoners and said, where's this Bunyan prisoner? And the jailer almost lost his life for it. And when Bunyan got back, it was strict confinement thereafter. And month after month, year after year, Bunyan's going to teach himself how to make the little eye holes for shoelaces. And he's going to make these. And his wife's going to bring in the raw materials and he's going to make them. And he's going to give them to his wife, and she's going to sell them. He's going to use music to while away the time. He was a remarkable musician. With his bellows, he had taken metal and fashioned his own violin. That violin is still in existence. You can still play it. He had no musical training, and he had done it all himself. Well, while he's in jail, he unscrews a leg off of a stool, and he hollows it out by hand and bores holes in it, and it becomes a playable flute. I talked to some of the music people at Maranatha, says you can't just randomly put holes in a piece of stick and get a flute. And Bunyan made a flute that you can still play today. It's in the Bunyan Museum. He carved his initials into it. And his initials are carved into the metal violin as well. This is a remarkable man. And so he's singing hymns, and he's sharing the gospel, and he's counseling, and he's thriving spiritually in the jail. And he starts, and he studies. He reads his Bible in Fox's Book of Martyrs. He's counseling. He is surviving. How is he surviving? by considering the grace of God to him. And he writes one of the great books in Christian history, Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. I recommend you read this. It's a little rambly. There are some sections where you feel like, let's get on with the story. It's a little preachy, but it is his personal story of how he came to Christ. And it is a magnificent book. And he addresses it, I'm writing from the lion's den, because he wrote this in jail. And in this book, he cites 2 Corinthians 1:9, my theme verse. There's the verse. We had the sentence of death. And here is Bunyan's testimony about this verse. And if you get nothing else from this Bunyan story, I want you to learn what Bunyan learned from the providence of God. By this scripture, I was made to see that if ever I would suffer rightly, I must first pass a sentence of death upon everything that can properly be called a thing of this life, even to reckon myself, my wife, my children, my health, my employment, my enjoyment, and all as dead to me and myself as dead to them. The second was to live upon God that is invisible. That is, when everything's stripped away but God, is he enough? All right, that's what Bunyan's learning in this jail. And he's discovering that God is enough. He said, I often did say before the Lord that if to be hanged up presently before their eyes would be means to awaken them and confirm them in the truth, I gladly should consent to it. So there are two principles here, two keys. Finding satisfaction in God alone and seeking redemptive purpose in suffering. And Bunyan is learning both of these lessons. God is doing things here, in me and through me. Meanwhile, England is going through a lot of problems. Parliament is really clamping down. They pass a whole bunch of laws. The Conventicle Act said there's a limit of 5 people in any religious meeting. That is, they're trying to shut down all churches except the Anglican Church. And it's severely repressive, and it doesn't look like Bunyan is ever going to get out of jail. That is, at this point, he's not serving an 8-year sentence. He's in jail until he agrees not to preach. And the plague of 1664 comes. Now, this is a horrible event for a lot of people. 1/5 of the Londoners died. Now, there were worse in the 17th century, but imagine 20% of a city dying. Wealthy people all flee. But a year later, 2 years later, the Great Fire of London happens, which many people are tied to all the destruction by the plague. And this Great Fire burns down a big part of the city, and it drives all the rats and the lice on the rats out of the city, which has the unexpected consequence of the plague spreading out into England. Well, the plague comes to Bedfordshire. And what you can't do is leave people in a jail during a plague. Everyone will die. And so the prisoners are released. Get that. This horrible calamity happens in London, and then another horrible calamity, which results in a horrible calamity, which gets Bunyan out of jail. He's reunited with his family for the first time, and Elizabeth gets pregnant with their 6th child. And then the plague passes, and Bunyan's back in jail. He missed the birth of his daughter, Sarah, because he was back in prison. And then about that time, he gets word that the daughter he just got to spend some time with, his blind daughter Mary, has passed away, and he's not going to be able to spend any more time with her. He had published 9 treatises while he was in jail for those first 6 years. Over the next 6 years, he's not going to publish any more treatises. By the way, there was an evangelical publisher in London who took great risks to publish Bunyan's writings. But he got away with it and got really rich, because Bunyan's writings are going to sell well. But even though Bunyan doesn't publish anything, he's still writing. In fact, he says, I have determined, the Almighty God being my help and shield, yet to suffer, if frail life might continue so long, even until the moss shall grow up on my eyebrows, rather than violate my faith and principles. All right, that's one of the Bunyan quotes that everybody, I'm going to be here till the moss is growing. But what's he working on? He's working on this idea of using allegory. There were a few allegories circulating. He didn't invent the genre. People used it for children's literature and whatnot. But nobody's reading those allegories now. He decided that, you know what, let's portray the life of a Christian from in a deplorable, dangerous, deadly situation all the way to the celestial city and what is involved. And so he begins working on the Pilgrim's Progress. He's in Bedford jail for 12 and a half years. He doesn't have any reason to believe he'll ever get out. Elizabeth cares for their kids. Mary, who passes away at 16. Elizabeth, who goes from age 6 to 18 while he's in jail. John, who goes from age 4 to 16. Thomas, from age 2 to 14. And Sarah, he misses the first 5 years of her life. And then, in 1672, an amazing thing happens. Charles II, that dirty, rotten rascal, is kind of a closet Roman Catholic. But it's against the law to be Roman Catholic, and there are Roman Catholics in jail all over England. And Charles decides that, you know what, I haven't pushed Parliament around much, but I'm going to now. And he says, I want to favor all my Roman Catholic friends, so he forces through Parliament a dispensation so that all dissenters can get out of jail. Now, he's not doing it for spiritual reasons. And in fact, the jailers, the nobility in Bedfordshire, are really frustrated because they do not want to let Bunyan out of jail. And so for the next several months, they do everything they can to try to get around this. They let all the Catholics out. They let the Quakers out. But they don't want to let Bunyan out. They really hate this guy. And then finally, on September 13, 1672, Bunyan is released from prison under a royal dispensation to help out the Catholics. And that brings us to the last part of his life. 1672 to 1688, let me look at the time. Oh, we're doing well. Any questions? All right. He's finally able now to apply for a license to preach. Now we'd have to get into the politics where there are these two parties forming in Parliament. During the 17th century, English politics changes a great deal from being a divine right monarchy to being kind of a parliamentary run country. And there's this party, the Whigs, and there's the other party, which is strongly supportive of the Anglican Church. And whenever the Whigs are in power, they kind of like dissenters and they want to undermine the Anglicans because the Anglicans are strong in the House of Lords and the Whigs are sort of against them. It's more complicated than I could explain, and it's more complicated than you want to have explained. But the Whigs get control of Parliament and start favoring dissenters, and they say, you can't just have a conventicle without any oversight, but if you got a license from Parliament to preach, we'll let you have a non-Anglican church. Well, this is a brand new idea. It's a dangerous idea, because what could government do when the Whigs fall from power? Well, now they know where you are. You got a license. All right, so getting a license from the government is always a bit of a two-edged sword. But most of the dissenters were so thrilled that something is being offered that has never been offered before that Bunyan goes and gets a license to preach, if you can believe it. The local Bedfordshire authorities were just outraged. And as he is walking out of the jail back to his home, he passes by an empty lot that's for sale. And he goes to his people and says, you know, let's buy that lot and put up our own meeting house. Because when Charles was restored, the Anglicans moved back into St. John's and the Baptists were kicked out. So they've been meeting in houses and just trying to stay out of the limelight. Most of the members of Bedford Jail had spent some time in and out of prison, in and out of jail. And so they build a new building and he becomes the pastor of the Bedford meeting with property procured there in Bedford. And he has a dynamic pastoral ministry. He doesn't just preach there, he preaches all over the place. Because he's the great Bunyan. In fact, he's so busy, he doesn't have time to publish this little allegory he'd been working on. And then persecution comes again. Because the Whigs fall from power. And the Royalists take over again. And they pass laws against dissent again. And now, they are tracking down all the dissenters who got licenses to preach. And they're also giving cash rewards to any citizen who turns in one of these conventicles. It becomes virtually a police state. Some of the worst persecution they'd experienced, and Bunyan has a warrant issued for his arrest. It's like, oh no, here we go again. So Bunyan flees into exile, leaving his family. And he's pretty well known now across England for his various writings, and he travels outside Bedford for over a year, mostly in southeastern England, going to different dissenters' homes and being welcomed and preaching sort of undercover, and he's surviving, but he's away from his family again. And in 1676, he says, you know what? I can't live like this the rest of my life. I've got to go home and just see what happens. And he goes home and they arrest him. And this time, according to pretty reliable tradition, rather than putting him in the Bedford jail, they put him in the town clink, which was a little dank, dirty jail, which was built at the end of the bridge over the River Ouse. And there he is. And when Bunyan is sitting there in jail, wondering if he's ever going to get out, he says, you know, I wrote that thing about Christian making his progress to the celestial city, and I've never gotten that published. Maybe I should. We don't know how much writing he did. He may have written it earlier, but during this 6 months, he does write the introductory poem to the Pilgrim's Progress, which is a beautiful poem. And in that poem, he says, you know, a lot of people have said, don't publish this. It's a little too childish, and it's got so much metaphor in it, and it's easier for people just to read the Bible. So it's a bad idea. Others had said, we think this is great. Why don't you publish it? And in his introductory poem, in rather poetic language, he says, you know, I thought about it. I had voices on both sides, and I finally decided, you know what? If it gets published and it dies, no problem, but I might as well put it out there. And he was jailed for 6 months. But he had made a friend in his travels by the name of John Owen. John Owen was a Puritan theologian, maybe the greatest theologian of all the Puritans. And John Owen heard about this preacher getting thrown in jail again. John Owen was a courageous man and had his own share of suffering. But he was also the court preacher for Charles II and had enormous influence. And John Owen got involved in this case. And he went to some powerful people and said, listen, these books are all over the place. This is a harmless, good man. He never supports insurrection. He never supports any royal propaganda. Let this man out of jail. And they did. Bunyan was released June 21st, 1677. And as soon as he was released, he said, oh, good, let's publish my book. And that year, the first half of The Pilgrim's Progress was published, December 1677, and it sold out in a matter of weeks. And the publisher said, I think we've got our hands on something good. And they started putting out new editions, a revised second edition, immediately. And it's selling everywhere. But there was another political swing in 1680. The Whigs fell from power yet again. The Tories come up with a vengeance. We are told that the persecution now was the most severe that they had yet experienced under Charles II. Up in Scotland, they were slaughtering people. All right, they call them the killing fields. So many Scots Christians were being murdered. It wasn't quite that bad in England, but it was bad. The Bedford meeting went completely underground and said, you know, we've got to go into hiding. We can't meet in our building anymore. Bunyan had been nicknamed Bishop Bunyan because he was using so much influence. And he's still traveling around preaching, but these meetings have to be in secret. In fact, we read of him sneaking into London under cover of darkness and meeting with dissenters and the word going out, and they're finding warehouses and him preaching to crowds of 400 and 500 people under cover of darkness, basically avoiding detection. It's probable that if he had not just published Pilgrim's Progress, he probably wouldn't have gotten away with it. That is, he was doing things that were illegal. But do you really want to arrest somebody that people and their families all over the country think are like the greatest guy ever? 8 editions of Pilgrim's Progress had come out in 4 years. So the Lord was protecting him. And he was using his platform to do more writing. Anybody ever read The Holy War? I've read a reduced edition of it. My wife used to tell a children's edition of The Holy War on flannel graph. Was it flannel graph? No, it wasn't flannel graph. It was one of those flip boards. Yeah. But The Holy War is another allegory of man's soul, which is delivered from Diabolus by Prince Emmanuel, who then goes to a far country, and Diabolus attacks man's soul through the 5 gates, which are the 5 senses. There's a cast of thousands. It's a very complicated book. Much more complicated than Pilgrim's Progress, but it's brilliant theology again. I think you would agree. And it was another bestseller. And if you're hardy, you should read it. The interesting thing about Pilgrim's Progress, well, I think I'm jumping the gun a little bit. I'll give you this quote first. Charles II once said to John Owen, how can a learned man like you sit and listen to an illiterate tinker? To which Owen replied, may it please your majesty, I would gladly give up all my learning if I could preach like that tinker. Well, Pilgrim's Progress was such a brilliant book that people didn't view the characters as just literary characters. And Bunyan starts getting letters from people. It wasn't right for Christian to leave his wife and kids behind. I mean, those people are going to die back there. Christian should have loved his wife enough to do something to bring her. This is a literary character. Bunyan's trying to teach that you leave all behind to get saved, but they're such real characters that he's getting all this mail and he says, well, I can solve this. And he writes Pilgrim's Progress Part 2, in which the wife, Christiana, also gets saved and the kids get saved and they all go on the pilgrimage. And it's probably not quite as good as Part 1, but it's well worth reading. Got a lot of good theology again, another beautiful, powerful story. So if you read Pilgrim's Progress, read the whole thing. You will enjoy the whole thing. But there's a government crackdown on dissenters. Right about the time Part 2 comes out, and Bunyan is afraid he's going to be arrested again. He's hearing tremors. So he deeds all of his property over to his wife, because if he's arrested, he won't have any goods to confiscate. He feared all the way to the end of his life. He never really could have peace that the pressure was off. But then there was a turn of events. We've had a few of those. James succeeded Charles. Charles II finally died in 1685, 25 years of horrible rule. His brother James was less immoral, but a worse king. James II was a thoroughgoing Catholic. He had a personal priest that he carried around with him, even though it was against the law. And James II was mismanaging everything about the government. But he had no heir. I mean, he had a couple daughters, but he had no son. And so everybody was like, okay, he's going to die soon, no problem. And then his wife had a baby. And this is a disaster for the government. They don't want to handle, you know what, I've gotten ahead of my story again. I should be turning these pages instead of just looking at my screen. 1687, the turn of events. There's going to be two turn of events, and I jump to the second one. James II is a friend of Catholics, and he does what his brother had done some years earlier, and he gives a Declaration of Indulgences lifting persecution, 1687. He was seeking allies. The dissenters had been down this road before. That is, they had accepted the licenses, and then the government had turned on them. So they were pretty skeptical this time. But what it did do for Bunyan is it freed him up to go preach to crowds of 500 without being fearful of arrest. And his preaching ministry explodes. He's invited to London over and over again. We're told of crowds of 1,200 or more gathering in large assemblies to hear this tinker preach. He became enormously popular. He's also still writing. He writes 10 new works. Eventually, this tinker with a third grade education is going to have 60 published works to his name. And he's a young man. He's in his 50s. This could go on for another 20 years. We finally have some measure of freedom. And a dad and his son are having an argument. They're fighting with each other. And Bunyan hears about it, and he had a relationship with the family. So he decides to travel there and help them out. He's going to London anyway for a preaching engagement, and they live in Reading. Bit of out of the way, but he stops off in Reading, and he begs this father and son to get along with each other, to forgive one another, and he's successful. He reunites them. But on his way back to London then, he gets caught in a downpour. Before he left, he had had a bout with the flu. It had weakened his lungs, but he had made it through it, and he felt like he was feeling well enough to go on this trip. But now he's getting, the rain is pouring on him. And the scientists can tell you that rain doesn't cause you to get sick, but don't believe them. You always get sick after you get rained on. But he gets better. He gets to London, he rests for a little while, and he's able to preach. And he holds some magnificent services, and everybody feels like he's fine. And then he has a relapse. And he's struggling to breathe. And then on August 31st, he suddenly dies. His lungs just give out. He was 59 years old. Elizabeth had been notified at first, but then they had told her, you know what, he's getting better. You know, stay with the kids, don't worry about it. She's unable to get to his side. And then he is buried in Bunnell Fields, the famous graveyard for dissenters, where Isaac Watts and Susanna Wesley and many others are buried. In fact, that monument is in Bunnell Fields today, built much later, of course. Poor Elizabeth, she survived. But how's she going to support herself? Well, she found 10 manuscripts on his desk that had not yet been published, and they were published, and the proceeds supported her and the kids. But she passed away 3 years later. She was 53 years old. But the thing I jumped the gun on now happens. James II's wife has a son, and everybody's like, we are not waiting around for another Stuart to grow up. We are sick of these Stuarts. All right, James I, Charles I, Charles II, James II, they're all terrible kings. So there is a glorious revolution. And basically, Parliament says, James, you're fired, leave. And James says, I'll raise an army. And everybody says, nah, we're not fighting for you. And it was a bloodless revolution. And he fled the country. And they invited his daughter Mary, who was married to William, Stadtholder of Orange in the Netherlands, to come be king and queen. And they did. But William believed in freedom of religion. And he said, I'm not coming unless all Protestants are free to worship God as they see fit permanently. And shortly after assuming the throne, the Act of Toleration is passed. Baptists from all over England celebrate it by gathering in a great meeting in which they publish the Second London Confession and are free finally to worship God as they see fit. Baptists are free, but Bunyan was already worshiping in the Celestial City. He had been freed just a few months before. So we conclude with some lessons. Bunyan learned that salvation is free. You don't earn it. Bunyan learned that the furnace is designed to produce gold. I don't know if we'd have a Pilgrim's Progress apart from 13 years in prison. But we do. Bunyan learned that God is enough. And you could probably come up with other lessons that Providence has taught us in the life of Bunyan. Any thoughts on that? You can either give lessons or we can leave these last 3 minutes to Pastor Michael. No, and that is the tracking the kids of these famous people is so difficult, and most of the time we just don't know. Every once in a while we have these wonderful insights. Most of the time we don't. I don't know anything about his kids, and I've never read anything about his kids in any of the biographies, and read several on Bunyan. Yeah, they didn't have, but most of them were grown by this time. Yeah, but they lost their mom quite young. They didn't have any wealth. He didn't accrue wealth through his sales. He really didn't. Back then, authors got very little cut of their books. Nowadays, authors don't get huge cuts. But back then, they got very, very little. Publishers made most of the money. And Bunyan would have given away the money if he'd gotten it. And so his family wasn't left with much, bless you, but his kids were mostly out of the house, but don't know what happened to him. Yes, sir. Here's evidence that it was a literary convention. I think it was a literary convention because when you're reading Pilgrim's Progress, you get to a certain point in the story, and then Bunyan says, and I awaked from the dream. And then the next chapter says, and I dreamed again, and the story picks up. And it's like, why did Bunyan put that? What's that about? Faith Cook hypothesizes that year that Bunyan got out, in 1666, he was writing, he was given an amnesty, went home and was with his family for a number of months, and then he was put back in jail. That may be the, I woke up, and then, I got to go to sleep again. I'm back in jail. So that the being asleep and wake is a metaphor for him being dormant, if you will, in the jail. And that kind of a convention, I fell asleep and had a dream, and here's what it was not unique at the time. So I would not go out on a limb and say that there was something supernatural about him dreaming this. That's an interesting question. But I meant to mention that. The whole I woke up and fell asleep, nobody's ever fully explained that, but that could be the best explanation. Yes, ma'am. It's called Fearless Pilgrim. I've read several biographies of Bunyan. When I read Fearless Pilgrim, it just blew them all away. I mean, it's a magnificent biography. And she fills in a whole lot of gaps that earlier scholarship struggled to figure out, and she gives very compelling answers. And Faith Cook's a wonderful writer. She's got a number of church history works. Read any of them. She's a contemporary scholar who works with Ian Murray over in England. Yes, ma'am. Gospel Truths Opened. That one is very much a child of its times and a refutation of Quakerism. I don't know if you would enjoy it as much. The three that I warmly recommend are Holy War, Pilgrim's Progress, and Grace Abounding the Chief of Sinners. His book, I can't remember. He also wrote a lovely book on the Gospels that explains the Gospel. I can't remember what it is now. It was right on the edge. I can't find it. He wrote a couple other books worth reading, but most of his later works are better than those early productions. All right, I think our time is gone and we're all ready for lunch. But, yes, sir. Yeah, I get what you're saying about history repeating itself, because the patterns are going to repeat because there's not an infinite number of them, and our sinfulness never changes. Our political systems go through change, but there's a limited number of possible permutations. In another way, history is very linear, heading towards final solution. And there's always going to be distinctiveness about each era which is not replicated in the other era. And so each era, God providentially works in those specific circumstances. But the value of studying history is seeing that a Bunyan or an Athanasius or a Tyndale, they didn't know what the next step was. When they're going down, they're not aware that it's going to turn up. They just know they're going down. And that's when they've got to trust God. And when circumstances improve, they can't trust in circumstances. They've got to trust in God. The ups and downs that we all experience and that these people experienced in rather dramatic fashion are supposed to teach us that our joy, our faithfulness, nothing that's important about us should depend on how today is going. It should depend on something more anchored.